From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today's newscast is a rebroadcast of the program Crosstalk from RT with host Peter Laveau, who's a frequent guest here on the CPR News. This is the week between Christmas and New Year's. We have a very small staff at Community Public Radio, and we try to broadcast every day, bringing you stuff you don't hear anywhere else. Today's program is well worth hearing, and it's entitled Neocons Return to Power. This discussion is not something you're going to hear anywhere else in the United States.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. President Donald Trump's 2017 National Security Strategy report tells us how he sees the world, or rather, how the Washington foreign policy leads to. For a candidate who ran on a message of change, the report is unremarkable in its defense of status quo policies and views. Clearly, Washington's neocons are running the show. Crosstalking National Security Strategy. I'm joined by my guest in Washington, Michael O'Hanlon. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. And we have Brian Becker. He is the director of the Answer Coalition, as well as host of Loud and Clear, a daily news show on Radio Sputnik. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Brian, let me go to you first. I'll be quite blunt. I mean, I read it quite carefully. It seems more or less a continuation of what we've seen for almost the last 30 years. It actually seems a lot more confrontational, I would say. Some of the points that about trade, I actually agree with. On immigration, I actually agree with. More or less the same. The people that wrote the 2017 report could have written the one to justifying the Iraq War. If you actually compare texts, they're very similar in the words they use. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, I think I'm glad you mentioned the Iraq War, because the National Security Strategy, which is a congressionally mandated report from the executive branch, it sometimes is a predictor of what's coming. And in the case of George W. Bush, 6 months before the invasion, the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, Bush came out with the National Security Strategy, which provided, although he didn't use the exact words of preemptive war, it was the logic of preemptive war. In other words, the U.S. arrogating to itself the right to perceive threats and go to war against them even before the U.S. has been attacked. Of course, that would be a violation of the U.N. Charter and international law. But nonetheless, it became a powerful logical explanation for what came later. The question now with Donald Trump's national security strategy is, does this predict where Trump is really going? And I think it does. I mean, he mentioned China 24 times. Mm-hmm. The report mentions China 24 times, all of them in a bellicose, aggressive way. It mentions Russia in a bellicose and aggressive way. There's no kind words for either China or Russia. Iraq and North Korea are rogue states. And of course, non-state actors, terrorism is the third dimension of the threat to America. And so you have the Trump administration sort of bringing together the America First or overarching sort of agitprop of the Trump election campaign with this idea that the rise of China or the reemergence of Russia now back on its feet means that America is receding, that America is being humbled, that America is the victim, that America is threatened. And so I think what Trump has actually done is articulate the not just the possibility of a new Cold War, but the logic of a new Cold War, and thus it becomes almost official in Washington, and things will follow from that.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting takeaway. Mike, what was your reaction to it? It was over a year ago, I think it was, when we still had candidate Trump, and he was in the national interest, I think his article was. I mean, this principled realism. I still don't see anything principled, and I don't see any really realism in it here. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi, Peter. Nice to be with you. I agree with some of what Brian just said. I do think that there is a tone in the report that is strong and that tries to push back and that pushes back strongly against China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran. I agree with all that. I do, however, and by the way, you're aware, I'm not a supporter of President Trump, and I never was, but I know who he is, and I know why he got elected. And the putting America first concept, if I could just begin with that in my first comment, because that is the centerpiece of the opening page and I think the title of the report, or at least the subtitle. And I think, frankly, the way in which that concept is described is basically okay. Now, I share some of your and Brian's concerns about the tone towards certain countries. We can come back to that. But putting America first, of course, can be interpreted as a zero-sum competition among nations, or it can be interpreted as here are principles we're going to try to live by. We expect others to live by them. And if we can all do that, then we can all prosper. And at least in terms of the theory of the report, at least in terms of the language that's on the paper, I think that it's more the second, that in fact, there is an effort here to say we should be able to get along with other countries. So some of the criticisms about the sort of generally negative tone of the report, I don't really agree with that. I do agree that the report is very tough on China and Russia and North Korea and Iran.
Okay, Brian, let me read you a short fragment here. And this is directly directed to Russia and China. These competitions, Russia and China, require the United States to rethink the policies of the past two decades, policies based on the assumption that engagement with rivals and their inclusion in international institutions and global commerce will turn them into benign, amazing actors and trustworthy partners. For the most part, this premise turned out to be false. I mean, this is really remarkable. It is, you know, it's not the international system. It's the international system as it's perceived and constructed by the Washington consensus. And if the Chinese and the Russians don't want to play by our rules, Washington's rules, they are rivals, even adversaries. I find it this language extremely arrogant because it doesn't bring good foreign policy results for the United States, and I would say for the world. Go ahead, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. I'm so glad that you read that particular part of the report because it says so much. It's not just that part of the report is not simply an attack on Russia or China. It's a repudiation of past U.S. policy or the perception of U.S. policy since the end of the Soviet Union. When they're talking about going back a couple decades, we're talking about going back to the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc countries. So Trump is repudiating the past 25 years. Well, during the past 25 years, the United States sought to function as a unipolar dominating power, but still used a multilateral institutions. In other words, kept the framework of multilateralism, the hallmark of American foreign policy at the conclusion of World War II, and key to the construct of the post-World War II world order that had the United States in charge, but in a multilateral framework where different powers, including its defeated enemies from World War II, Japan and Germany, had a place. They had a place as junior partners, where they were given access to markets, etc., rather than what happened after World War I. Trump, I think, is stepping back on a lot of levels, the abandonment of the Paris Climate Treaty, the rejection of TPP, the rejection of almost anything that has to do with a multilateral framework, the ripping up of the Joint Comprehensive Plan or trying to sabotage it, the Iran nuclear arms deal. We see in this document that thus, in America First, it says America will be the dominant power. We're no longer going to pretend that multilateralism is enough to keep China and Russia and other countries in their place because they are rising. And so America must put them back in their place. And thus, it will be by the exercise of American clout, American threats, American intimidation. We see that at the UN today. Trump is telling the rest of the world, if you vote the wrong way today on Jerusalem, you're going to be punished. That's not engaged. That's bellicosity and using either military or the threats of military or economic aggression or sanctions as the way of disciplining or policing the new post-World War and now post-Cold War order.
That's very interesting. You know, Mike, when I read the report, I found it to be very defensive about defense, okay? Because what really disturbed me was the lack of using diplomatic tools. I really very much agree with what Brian was saying. having to say here. I mean, particularly China. I mean, we've seen this in history over and over again, a rising power. Either you back off and let it happen, you deal with it, or you have a war, okay? And it seems to me, out of the three options here, this administration is actually telling us, get ready for a confrontation. I don't think it's really necessary, but that's what it looks like. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, Peter, so thank you. And let me focus, like you just did, on China for a minute. I thought it was a little too strong, the report, in terms of how it talked about China. I think there should have been a statement to acknowledge just how far China's come and how much progress it's made. And the order, the international order that you and Brian were talking about, did help make it possible. So it was American strategy, in conjunction with other countries, including the Soviet Union, but also our allies, that created a UN system, and then in the West, that created an economic system that facilitated China's rise. So whatever China's rise has become, it was partly our doing and partly our hope. Now, there are problems in the U.S.-China economic relationship, and I think we do need to take those very seriously. But I agree with you that the tone overall is too negative. You know, right now we have security concerns about China, but that is to some extent inevitable with a rising power. And I think overall, I have worries about China too, but most of its military activities that we don't like are in the uninhabited islets of the South China Sea, and they're not attacking other countries. They're not doing things that historically, you know, rising powers did at the beginning of the 20th century, okay, for example.
You know, Mike,
so I thought we should have been a little more measured in the tone
towards
China.
I agree with you. Mike, let me stay with you here. Put yourself in the Chinese position in Beijing, and they read this report here, and then they hear from the American White House or the State Department, why don't you help us more on North Korea? I mean, if I was sitting in Beijing, I'd say, well, what are you talking about? These are your words, this is your official policy, and you come to us for help? I mean, it's really quite remarkable. The same thing actually can be applied to Russia. I mean, bellicose language towards Russia, but then they say, we need your help, or you're not doing enough to fight terrorism. I mean, if you're outside that bubble, it's really kind of odd rhetoric coming out of this government here. 30 seconds, I'll stay with you, Mike, before we go to the break. Go ahead.
Well, I would treat Russia and China very differently, and I'm sure we'll come back to Russia
after the break.
It was interesting that in his speech, President Trump did not use negative language, especially about Russia. In fact, he talked about the phone call he and President Putin had, thanking each other for recent cooperation. And so that was a distinct contrast. The speech was a distinct contrast to the written report.
Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's view of the world. Stay with RT.
This is a special edition of the CPR News. I'm Don DeBar, and this is the program Crosstalk from RT with host Peter Laveau.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. To remind you, we're discussing Trump's view of the world. Okay, to continue discussion, where Michael Flanagan, he's going to join us. He's the president of Flanagan Consulting, and he's a former congressman. Michael, it's good to have you on the program. As we entered the first half here, we were talking about this report that the president has put out, and we were talking about Russia and China. And Mike, also in Washington, he pointed out something that, you know, the tone, while both negative to both countries, is slightly less negative towards Russia. I know what that's all about, and I'm going to say it before I ask you a question. That train has already left the station. There's always been a suspicion here, or hope, that, you know, you could divide Russia and China to have to slow down their kind of growing alliance, strategic alliance. And I think that's a pipe dream now. I think that is over. And I don't think the Russians are going to be enticed back. There are not enough sticks, and there are not enough carrots for that after what's happened over the last few years. You know, talk about that a little bit there, because that's a strategy that people want to have happen, but it isn't going to happen. Go ahead.
I'm not sure Trump wants that to happen. I think the gist of this document, I think, and you have to read it in the main. From what the discussion that I've heard so far is parsing the exact words, and that's a wonderful thing to do. It's appropriate, but in the main, I think we're seeing a move in strategic views of the world by the United States that A, puts America first, and it's not about America over Japan, over Russia, over Europe. It's about America. We're going to take care of what we need to take care of at home before we give away sovereignty, money, work, whatever else we need to put ourselves in peril for some other external need. And I think that's what's being said here. And I just came back from a conference in India where that same confusion kind of reigned among internationals. We really didn't understand that America first is a common doctrine in every country. What country would not want its own government to put its own people first internally and then externally do its work for it? So I think we got to kind of have a base understanding of that to begin with. Secondly, you're seeing a huge emphasis of using trade and using economics as foreign policy, and more so than the United States has done in maybe 100 years. And I think that's a lot of what's at work here. The tough language with Russia, China, it's in here. Yes, it's in there. And I joined the panel and wish that it were not so tough. But then again, you have a non-diplomat in the Oval Office. You've got a guy there who speaks very plainly and also is the art of the deal. So there's always a certain give and take into what he says. Does he really mean this? Does he really mean that? Well, in the main, he's being honest with you, but the emphasis kind of goes back and forth. Well, and so I wouldn't live and die on particular words or phrases in there.
No, that's a really extremely good point. And I've already mentioned in the program when the report addresses immigration and trade, I'm pretty much in agreement. I mean, and that's what he ran on, and that's what he's doing as president here. But Brian, you know, taking on board what we just heard there, I think they want it both ways, because I do see Donald Trump's fingerprints on this, but I see, you know, 30 years of neoconservatives, their fingerprints all over it as well. And that's that's why it makes a kind of a difficult read to try to figure out, you know, to glean through what's really happening here. Because, I mean, look at the emphasis on Israel and Saudi Arabia. And of course, you know, Iran is described as the scourge of the world. I mean, what kind of serious document says scourge of the world? I mean, we all pretty much know where that came from. Go ahead, Brian.
Yes, I consider this document, while still representing a lot of continuity in U.S. foreign policy, and of course it's partly drafted by National Security Council and the Joint Chiefs and the CIA, they all get a first dib at the first drafts. There is continuity, but I think this represents a sharp shift, especially given the fact that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the so-called Iran nuclear arms deal, for instance, could have been the precursor to a new sort of thaw in relations between the United States and Iran in the Middle East. I mean, they're cooperating in Iraq. They have the same enemy in some ways in Syria, or at least they say they do. But this is a sharp reversal of any sort of possibility for that. The confrontational language with China and with Russia, which goes against what Trump was sort of suggesting, which during the campaign and afterwards, like, why not have good relations with Russia? Doesn't it make sense? This document adopts a strategic orientation that goes in a different direction. The America First stuff is sort of a combination of campaign sloganeering and still, you know, some differentials in trade policy and immigration. But in terms of foreign policy orientations towards Russia, China, major players, it doesn't. It's not the same. And I think that we're going down. This is the embrace of the new Cold War and providing the logic for the new Cold War. And if anything, it means Trump is not only just capitulated, not just surrendered to the Cold Warriors and the neocons, but he's enthusiastically embracing it. He wanted to do it. He's the first president to actually articulate what's in the document at the time of its publication. Bush didn't do that. Obama didn't do that. He wasn't required to do it. He wanted to do it. And that's where Trump is heading.
Okay, you know, Mike, one of the things that's interesting to me is that, I mean, we still have, and I have already invoked the attack on Iraq, where, you know, it's all about American hegemony. And I know people don't like that word, but I mean, this document is basically saying to assure American hegemony, where there is no rival power that has a hegemony in one of the great regions of the world here. And this is a strategy to make sure that doesn't happen here. Okay, I can understand that, but I don't understand how that makes America great rigged again. I mean, look at all of the catastrophes U.S. foreign policy has experienced since the end of the Cold War, particularly in this century here. And I give a hat tip to Brian. I understand what he was saying about some of the differences. But at the core, it is still making sure that no other country in the world can rival the United States. But that the unipolar moment is coming to an end. Why doesn't the United States articulate a policy where it works in unison with other powers? We're not always going to agree on things. Rivalry is not always a bad word. Competition is good. But I don't see foreign policy elites in Washington understand this unipolar moment is coming to an end. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, Peter, let me hone in on one specific issue that your broad point raises, which is NATO expansion. And I'm going to make a hopeful comment here. I did not see the National Security Strategy reiterate our longstanding commitment to further NATO expansion. You may recall that I wrote a short book this summer in which I advocated that we no longer expand NATO, provided that President Putin would agree to resolve the territorial disputes to mutual satisfaction with Ukraine and Georgia, and also allow those countries someday to join the European Union if they're invited and so wish. That would be the new security architecture I propose. Nothing in this document rules that kind of idea out. There is not the traditional commitment to further expand NATO to the east, which I don't think is directed at Russia's expense. But if I were a Russian, I realize I would look at it perhaps quite differently. I realize most Russians do look at it differently. And I think we've gone far enough with that logic. Luckily, the National Security Strategy does not endorse further NATO expansion, at least not explicitly. And I hope that creates some room for maneuver on that issue. So your big broad points, that raises a lot of stuff
with
the whole global
order. Mike,
I want to hone in on Eastern Europe.
Yeah, but I know the thesis of your book here, and it's worth a conversation. I agree, okay? Though we're very far apart on this here. But, you know, we just had in the last news cycle, the Trump administration is going to sell lethal arms to Ukraine. Great. You know, that's just plain stupid. Just plain stupid, okay? And that's a topic for another program. Let me go back to Michael here, because I want to make sure you get a little bit more time on this program here. I mean, Michael, how does Trump's foreign policy make America great again?
That's a great question, and I wish this were a three-hour program, because I'd love to unpack what your guests have said. I mean, this is a great program, Peter. You're not wrong, but let me maybe focus your emphasis just a little bit aside. Again, it's a non-diplomatic president. It's a man who doesn't have a career in public office, and it's also a man who believes that personally, interpersonally, he is going to be able to deal with foreign leaders on a one-on-one basis. He enjoys a terrific relationship, at least on the surface, with the Premier of Japan, with the Prime Minister of Japan, with the Premier of China, with Mr. Modi in India, and other places as well. And in the recent past, they've had very positive personal conversations with Mr. Putin about things of interest to both countries, even after this document or while this document was being promulgated. So the document is national policy. Yes, of course. It's there's nothing in here that's a lie, certainly. But there's nothing in here that you have to take to the bank and nail to the wall and say this is absolutely going to be how it's going to be because it says so here. That's diplomat talk. That's government talk. I think you've got a guy who's going to work it in a way that he sees it in the exigency of the moment in the larger parameter of this document.
But Michael, let me go to Brian here. We're rapidly running out of time here. I mean, you know, again, you know, where's the diplomacy all this? And let's look at actions. I mean, you have Nikki Haley. I mean, she's a disgrace, gentlemen. She's a disgrace. That kind of behavior at that forum here. I mean, basically, we're going to take your name and watch out. We're going to remember you. I mean, that's just bullying. It's very primitive. There's no professionalism there. I mean, this isolates the United States. I mean, it's really truly an embarrassment on an international stage. Go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, indeed. But it's not that far different from what Trump is doing right now this week, threatening the member states of the UN. We're going to pay attention. We'll cut your aid. We don't care. Language like that. I think what we're witnessing here is I think the Trump orientation was to sort of retreat from the world stage. And I think Trump's policies are contributing to a U.S. Contraction from the world stage and its influence. You can't, as you said in the beginning, Peter, say to Xi Jinping in China, we really want to work together. We love you. We have a great relationship. You love us. And by the way, we're going to mention you 24 times in our national security report and discuss you in the most bellicose, aggressive way. And then expect China to be like, oh, that's great. No, China was shocked by this report. China was stunned. If you read the Chinese media this week, they were taken aback. They did not expect this to come, and they don't really count that much on the primacy of individual relations. This is an institutional document, even if some of it is just whatever language, the language of annual reports. Nonetheless, the Chinese see in this report something that they did not expect. They were very hopeful, and I think the Russians were earlier hopeful, that Trump would mean something new, something less oriented towards aggression and towards regime change, towards unipolar domination.
We have to stop here. We thank RT and Peter for that, and we close with this commentary from Black Agenda Radio's Margaret Kimberly.
The Democrats are in a very desperate state of affairs. That ought to be good news, but they will pose great dangers to millions of people before they experience their final death throes. The most visible tool for their attempt at self-preservation is the so-called Russiagate scandal, the investigation of alleged Russian interference in the 2016 election. Democrats have always hated the left far more than they hate the right. Under the guise of fighting Russian influence, they are now waging an all-out war against anyone who opposes them from that political direction. Hillary Clinton's defeat in the Electoral College in 2016 had to be explained away and defended, lest rank-and-file Democrats begin asking questions about their party's failures, which culminated in the Day of Reckoning. Russiagate explained the debacle perfectly and had the added advantage of continuing the war by other means against Russia. And that will continue because the Democrats are happy members of the bipartisan imperialist war party. Jill Stein, the Green Party presidential candidate, is the latest victim in the tawdry scam. She has been a convenient scapegoat for Democrats ever since the 2016 election. Hillary Clinton had the simple task of conducting a get-out-the-vote effort in key swing states, an important step on the path to Electoral College victory for Democrats. She raised $1 billion, enough money to do anything she wanted, and she had near universal support from the corporate media. Even many Republicans stood down in the belief that Donald Trump would lose. But Hillary is the one who fumbled what should have been a simple task, and in so doing created panic among the bipartisan ruling elite. Thus far, Russiagate reveals personal connections between Trump and individuals in Russia. We know that his son, Donald Trump Jr., is stupid, that former aide Paul Manafort is a crook, and that former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn spoke to Russia's ambassador, but on behalf of Israel. The flimsy evidence of collusion is built on repetition of dubious innuendo and the deliberate exclusion of any voices who might provide a counter-narrative. There are indications that some Republicans were willing to shove Trump under the proverbial bus, but the tax bill victory and Zionist clamoring for recognition of Jerusalem may have saved him from impeachment. But there will always be a Green Party to kick around and help the Democrats kill many birds with one stone. First, a Senate committee asked Donald Trump Jr. to produce any communication he had with Jill Stein. Stein immediately made clear that no such communication took place. Now that the investigation and the resolve to get Trump are teetering, Jill Stein has once again become the focus of cynical ire among duplicitous politicians, lackey pundits doing their bidding, and the passive, easily fooled Democratic Party membership. Stein has been asked to provide the Senate Intelligence Committee with any documentation relating to her 2015 trip to the RT anniversary gala held in Moscow. She was seated at a table with Flynn and Vladimir Putin, and that is all. But the image is blood in the water to the sharks. They have used everything from clickbait hustles emanating from a variety of Eastern European countries to an oligarch bailing out Trump's Miss Universe pageant to prove the most sinister motives possible. But the attack is not just on Jill Stein and Green Party vice presidential candidate Ajamu Baraka. It is an attack on the freedom of speech that Americans claim to revere so much. It is an attack on the ability to publicly oppose United States foreign policy and freely communicate with people and governments all over the world. The damage done by the persecution of Stein will emanate far beyond the Green Party. Already, Google, Facebook, and Twitter have publicly acknowledged that they are censoring speech and curtailing access to certain sites. The ruse has succeeded, and Democrats have joined Republicans in silencing anyone who opposes their joint efforts at promoting U.S. hegemony around the world. Let us be clear, Russia has decisively moved away from trying to appease the United States. Along with their allies, the Russians defeated the regime change attempt in Syria and have strengthened their relationship with China. The two countries are working together to protect themselves and thwart the U.S. whenever possible. Democrats and Republicans may convince the rubes that Russia interfered in the election when they actually have other causes for concern. But if Americans are afraid to speak out, to denounce their government as they've been told they have a right to do, the bad actors have a free hand. That is what they hope to accomplish by making an example of Jill Stein. And that is why she must be defended without hesitation or reservation by anyone who claims to be on the left.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.